From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. He may be my favorite TV talk show host, but his show is a parody of the real thing. On today's Fresh Air, we meet Gary Shandling, star of the HBO comedy series The Larry Sanders Show. Before Shandling started satirizing late-night talk shows, he hosted one. He used to be Carson's regular substitute. Also today, flirting. We talk with Australian writer and director John Digan about his new movie. It's the second part of a trilogy about a young boy from a small town awakening to the wider world. And Stephen Schiff reviews Eddie Murphy's new movie, The Distinguished Gentleman. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The United Nations Security Council has just voted to authorize the use of troops to protect relief shipments in Somalia. The resolution authorizes deployment of an armed force led by the United States to secure the distribution points for food and medicine needed by starving Somalis. Much of that aid has been looted by armed gangs. This evening's resolution was passed by a unanimous vote of the Security Council's 15 members. The wording of the resolution was deliberately vague, authorizing the use of all necessary means to create a secure environment for relief operations. President Bush has been contacting world leaders to marshal support for the multinational effort. Mr. Bush intends to resolve the military aspects of the intervention by January 20th, when Bill Clinton is sworn in as president. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Mr. Bush met with top military leaders this morning and has invited congressional leaders to the White House tomorrow for a briefing. The president also spoke with Bill Clinton yesterday. White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said Mr. Bush wants the operation completed before Clinton takes over. "We want to make it clear that the mission is to get humanitarian supplies in," he said, "not to establish a new government or resolve the decades-long conflict there." Governor Clinton told reporters in Little Rock today he has been kept informed, but he refused to comment definitively on the subject until he knows the full extent of the mission. U.S. Marines could be in the Horn of Africa by tomorrow to begin the operation. I'm Elizabeth Arnold in Washington.
The Bush administration has decided to release $54 million in economic assistance for Nicaragua, aid that had been blocked by U.S. concern over human rights problems in the country. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
Prodded by Senator Jesse Helms last spring, the State Department suspended $104 million in aid already appropriated for Nicaragua because the leftist Sandinistas, voted out of office 2 years ago, still had too much control over the country's army, because claims for property seized by the Sandinistas were not being addressed, and because human rights conditions were deteriorating. The State Department remains concerned about all this, continues to withhold $50 million of the $104 million total, but is releasing the other $54 million because spokesman Richard Boucher says the funds are needed to stabilize Nicaragua's economy and control inflation.
This is essential to Nicaragua's economic recovery and consolidation of democracy.
Senator Helms said President Bush had been tragically misled by his advisors in releasing the funds, and aides to the North Carolina Republican said he'll try to bottle up the remaining $50 million. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 10 points to close at 3,276.5. Advances edged declines in heavy trading of 238 million shares. This is NPR. General Motors auto plants in Delaware, New York, New Jersey, Ohio, and Michigan will close as part of the automaker's attempt to restructure its North American operations. GM named 8 U.S. plants that will shut down, completing its previously announced plans to close 21 factories by 1995. The plants named today employ about 18,000 people. On the sixth day of his trial in Berlin on 13 counts of manslaughter, the former East German leader Erich Honecker has spoken for the first time at length about the charges that arise from the shoot-to-kill policy at the Berlin Wall. Michael Lawton reports from Cologne.
It was a fighting speech in which the 80-year-old Erich Honecker admitted full responsibility for the deaths of those shot trying to cross the inner German border. Reading from a 26-page text in a voice weak from age and illness, he said that the East German leadership was saddened by every death, but that the border was necessary to prevent the danger of nuclear war. If the Berlin Wall had not been built in 1961, he said, the Soviet Union would have certainly intervened to prevent the undermining of its satellite state by the huge emigration of workers to the West. Honecker questioned the right of the court to try him. Only 5 years ago, he was received with full honours in West Germany as the head of state of an independent country. Other heads of state had not been tried for their controversial military actions, such as Kennedy's decision to send troops to Vietnam. This trial is a court of the victors over the vanquished, he said. For National Public Radio, this is Michael Lawton in Cologne.
The former chairman of the Solomon Brothers investment firm has agreed to pay a $100,000 fine for his involvement in last year's Treasury trading scandal. John Goodfriend will also be banned from heading another brokerage for the rest of his life. The scandal cost Goodfriend his job after 38 years with Solomon. I'm Corey Flintoff, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Live on tape from Hollywood, The Larry Sanders Show. Tonight, join Larry and his guests, John Stamos, Helen Reddy and the National Spelling Bee Champion, and me, hey now, Hank Kingsley. And now, because he's already been paid, so we might as well use him, Larry Sanders!
The Larry Sanders Show is a parody of late-night talk shows. It's often funnier than the real thing. My guest is the show's star and co-writer, Gary Shandling. Shandling parodies talk show hosts so well because he used to be the real thing. He used to be Johnny Carson's regular substitute host. But Shandling gave up The Tonight Show to concentrate on his first comedy series, It's Gary Shandling Show, which premiered in 1986. The Larry Sanders Show recently ended its first season. Beginning Monday, HBO will rebroadcast the series over 10 consecutive weekday nights. Gary Shandling was supposed to join us today from the NPR Bureau in Los Angeles. But shortly before the interview was about to begin, Gary's publicist called to say Gary had car trouble and couldn't get to the studio. So we recorded the interview from his home phone. Okay, so you can imagine what went through my mind when I found out that your car wouldn't start. In your talk show experiences, have you ever had that happen where someone doesn't show up and they say their car isn't working?
No, it is the flimsiest excuse, isn't it? It would be better to say my dog ate the car, I mean, or something. It sounds like one of those horrible high school excuses.
When you were guest hosting The Tonight Show, did guests ever, like, not show up for one reason or another? Did you have to do anything to improvise?
I will tell you once that, I never had that, although we are going to do an episode about that. In fact, I think we did an episode where we sort of had that one moment happened where they couldn't get Janet Jackson and she canceled at the last minute, and then T-Bone Burnett came in at the very last second and did it. And we've touched on that kind of stuff where someone drops out, and usually it's very interesting. Usually the Tonight Show or the Letterman Show has a list of about 10 people that they can always just call who live within a radius of 10 miles of the studio that will come on in case someone doesn't show up. And so I'm trying to think if I know who it is at the Tonight Show. They'll pick up the phone, for instance, and call Dick Cavett or something and say, you know, you want to come on. And there are always some people who are willing at the last second to come on.
So what kind of car do you drive that's giving you this trouble?
The worst story than that, what it is exactly, is my girlfriend bought a Range Rover, and I said to her, well, you know, a Range Rover in California, you know, it's a four-wheel drive vehicle, you know, and, you know, I guess she figures, you know, in case it starts raining, she can't get to that audition in time or something, you know. So it's a four-wheel drive. For me, it's a slightly affected car, although they're very nice cars, and it's hilarious because she bought it yesterday and it's brand new, and then she was going to drop me off at the studio and the car wouldn't start. So not only have I missed this opportunity to go directly to the studio, But simultaneously, she's been on the phone screaming at the car dealer saying, well, you know, Gary Shandling missed an interview, which, of course, meant far less to them than she'd hoped.
So listen, this talk show, you've done the talk show for real, you know, guest hosting on The Tonight Show, and now you're doing a parody of it. What's the difference, do you think, between Larry Sanders as a late-night host and Gary Shandling?
Well, you know, it's a good question. I actually think that on the talk show part itself, on the Larry Sanders show talk show part that we see live on the air, that is basically me hosting a talk show. That is how I would host a talk show. Larry is very different than Gary as a person, and what we see backstage is not exactly me. Larry is much more driven career-wise, much more competitive career-wise, much more concerned about ratings than I am, much angrier than I am. On the air, he is very similar to what I would be like hosting a show. I find myself, since it's a satire of talk shows, doing a few Johnny moves that I wouldn't probably do if it was really me, and doing a few kind of Letterman moves that I wouldn't do.
On some of the episodes, there's a lot of tension between what's happening off camera and what's happening on camera. I mean, there's one in which you're fighting with your wife, you know, kind of backstage, and then you have to keep running back on the air and being really affable. Has anything like that ever happened to you in the time that you really hosted?
That particular thing has never happened. I have been in a relationship where right before I went on stage, and this is what I took the moment from, it was many years ago, and I was getting ready to go on stage at the Comedy Store, and my girlfriend at the time said, you know, I really want to discuss our relationship. And I said, well, okay, but I'm on in 2 minutes. Well, she said, there's never a good time to talk to you, is there? And we were really having an argument right before I went on stage. And then that kind of thing never stopped. I was hit by, this is not a joke, I was hit by a car about 6 months after that, and I was in the hospital with all these tubes connected to me. And she came to the hospital, and I was on the critical list, and she said, I really want to talk to you about our relationship. And I was like on Demerol at the time. And I said, well, you know, if I don't think this is the right time, but anyway, it sounds like I probably was very shut down and not communicative, but I was, and she just picked the wrong time. So we took that element and made a show out of it.
Boy, I hope she wasn't thinking that you would do anything to get out of talking about the relationship. You'd do stand up, you'd get into a car accident, anything to avoid that discussion.
I never thought of it that way. But I guess when I joined the astronaut program,
my guest is Gary Shandling, and his series, The Larry Sanders Show, which satirizes talk shows, is going to be on 10 consecutive weeknights in a row on HBO starting on Monday. When were you old enough to stay up late enough to watch The Tonight Show?
Well, you know, I am one of those kids who became aware of comedians at a very early age. It was very odd that at the age of 10 I had memorized the Carl Reiner, Mel Brooks, 2,000-year-old man routine, and I was listening to that album, and I used to watch Don Rickles on TV, and I remember staying up late and watching Jack Parr when I shouldn't have been, and Steve Allen when I shouldn't have been. So, starting very early, I was very tuned into the world that I'm in now.
But you ended up in college studying engineering and marketing.
Yes, I was an electrical engineering major for 3 years.
So why did someone who loved comedy so much go into engineering?
Well, you know, I was in Tucson, Arizona. That's where I grew up. And you don't... And my parents are not in the arts. And so it wasn't like when I was 15 or 16, anybody encouraged me to go and be a comedian or to be in show business, and I had no real inputs in that direction. There were no clubs, I remember driving to Phoenix when I was 17 or 18 to see George Carlin work in a small club. That was the first time I'd ever been in a small kind of club before, nightclub. My parents used to take me to Las Vegas where I saw, I remember Don Adams was working in Las Vegas.
Get Smart
was
yeah.
popular. And I remember Don Adams telling old jokes. I was like 12 years old, and I went, my God, I thought to myself, he's doing old jokes. How can someone do an act with jokes that are old jokes? I remember thinking that when I was 12 years old, and I was aghast. I assumed that everybody wrote new their jokes. I didn't know you could go to a joke book, and that's what a lot of those guys used to do. So I was really tuned into that. And then my second or third year in the engineering department, I got very frustrated. And I sat down with myself and had a soul-searching conversation with myself and said, you know, what I'd really like to do is see if I can write comedy. And I just made a decision then when I was 19 or 20, well, you know, I was pretty old, to move to L.A. after I graduated. I switched my majors and said, I'll see what happens. And I moved to L.A. stone cold, didn't know anybody, didn't know how to go about it, and really started from scratch.
So what's the first move that you made once you got there?
Well, I started hanging out at the Comedy Store, watching comedians. The Comedy Store had just opened. It was 1972. And I just watched and watched, and I had a job as an advertising copywriter at the time. And watched and watched, and then I took a writing class at a comedy writing class at UCLA, and I met a guy whose father was a comedy writer, and we started talking, and we ended up writing a script together that he gave to his dad, and his dad said, God, this is really good, and he gave it to an agent, and I just kept meeting people here and there, and finally I wrote a script for Sanford and Son that I got to the producers, and they loved it, and they hired me, and they said, you should write a couple scripts for us this season. I was 23.
So the first
24, I think.
So the first TV show you worked on was Sanford and Son.
Yes.
It must have been strange to be a white guy from Tucson writing a black sitcom.
You know, they were all white writers, and I just did a little luncheon with Keenan Ivory Wayans, who of course created In Living Color. We were sitting next to each other, and he didn't know that I had written for Sanford and Son, and he couldn't stop laughing. He literally couldn't stop laughing for 5 minutes when I said, you know, I started on Sanford and Son, and just looked right at him. And he said, my God, you know, things have really changed, because it was primarily white writers that wrote that show. And, of course, now everybody is aware that we should be looking, meaning the industry, looking for new minority writers, and there are so many talented guys out there that should have been writing that.
So, did you write for Three's Company, too?
You know, I had a script assignment for Three's Company, and that's actually when I decided, that was right in the time when I was deciding, I just can't do this.
Well, talk about formulas.
It was when, in fact, really a voice deep down inside of me said, what are you doing? And it was very much like the engineering school when I just said, what are you doing? It was the same kind of feeling. And it was the same formulas over and over again. And I just said, I can't do this. And that's when I stopped and started to do stand-up.
Now, I think that the auto accident that you referred to earlier also had something to do with you deciding to change directions.
Well, there was a chain of events that happened. I was, you know, it was right around the time of... I'd finished my Welcome Back, Kotter, and I was doing a script for Three's Company, and I also had a pilot I was writing, and I was unhappy creatively, and then I got hit by a car, which we don't need the details of, but I was hit by a car and really seriously hurt, and as I was laying in the hospital, I really did realize, I had one of those realizations, like, you know, what do you really want to do in your life is what you should look at, and then try for that. And the only thing that I knew that I wanted to do was develop comedically. I've never had a goal other than when I was hosting The Tonight Show, which really was a goal of mine. But I never had a career goal. It was more an inside creative goal to learn learned to use my funniness and to discover what my level of ability was, and that's what I went after when I went on stage. It was really a self-discovery process.
So when you were lying there in the hospital, mm-hmm. fighting for your life, were you...
Funny? Was I funny?
Well, seriously, since you were thinking so much about comedy, were you already trying to transform this into, like, your next routine?
Yeah, I did. I wrote several routines in the hospital.
You really
but
did?
I wrote my first time on The Tonight Show, my first stand-up piece was a piece about being in the hospital and hearing that woman in the hospital paging doctors all day long going, Dr. Juergens, Dr. Mark Juergens, over that hospital intercom,
uh-huh.
Dr. McAvoy, Dr. John McAvoy. And I was in the hospital for 2 weeks, and I heard that hospital intercom 24 hours a day for 2 weeks, and I realized this woman could say anything, and no one would know the difference. She could go, Dr. Pudding, Dr. Chocolate Pudding, and someone would show up.
My guest is Gary Shandling. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Gary Shandling, and his comedy series, The Larry Sanders Show, will be shown over 10 consecutive nights on HBO beginning Monday. When you started doing stand-up, did you have a sense of who you wanted to be on stage? You know, like what aspects of your own personality you really wanted to bring out for your stage persona?
It was really a nightmare. I had no idea who I was when I started, and I was frightened to death and had no natural performing skills. I'd never performed before in my life, and to be thrown onto the stand-up stage is an experience that you cannot fathom until you're actually there, because there's no place to go, and everyone's looking at you, and you can't even see them because of the lights. And yet you have to manage to start talking and be funny on top of it. And at the beginning, I think I did. I wrote material that was very much influenced by Woody Allen, who's my favorite. And I used to do very offbeat jokes that sounded like I was reading them. And it took years to develop a style. And actually, what happened is I was involved in a relationship, and the girl left me, and I was very hurt, and I had to go up on stage, and I finally just turned to the audience and said, this girl left me. I said, what happened is she moved in with another guy. So I dumped her, because that's where I draw the line. and so that was the beginning. That was really the beginning of, you know, people of the Gary Shandling dating years in stand-up that came out, you know, because I realized, I started to really spill my guts about being hurt, and people really related to it. And it just was one of those things. It was in a nightclub in Dallas. I really remember it very well.
Can you give me a sense of what you were doing before you started doing the more personal stuff?
They were awful jokes like... you know, I had a high school principal who, actually this is true, I had a high school principal who committed suicide by hanging himself in the rings in the gymnasium. And it was the next day that my physical education coach found him hanging there in the rings, and he gave him a 9.8.
Oh, God.
And it was stuff like that. That really was not connected to, you know. Actually, that really all happened, of course, other than the 9.8, but every part of that story is true. I said I had a real stupid, I said my coach was really stupid. He had a big sundial in his front yard, and he pulled his back out trying to wind it. It was that kind of stuff that barely worked at all.
Oh, if you're just joining us, my guest is Gary Shandling, and his series, The Larry Sanders Show, is going to have a series of 10 shows played back-to-back on 10 consecutive weeknights on HBO starting this Monday. It seems to me one of the problems of becoming a celebrity is that celebrities start to take themselves really seriously and think of themselves as being just, like, terribly important.
Yeah.
And that to maintain the kind of humor that you're doing now on your shows, like, you know, the It's Gary Shandling Show and the Larry Sanders Show, you have to be a little bit detached from all of that in order to kind of see the humor of people taking themselves too seriously and to stand outside a little bit, both from celebrity land and from TV and movie land, and look into it. Do you worry about that being a bit of a problem, of ever getting too far inside?
You know, I think that's really a great perception. I think you're 100% accurate, and and that's smart. And you recognize something that a lot of performers don't recognize, and they do start to take themselves too seriously. The truth is that I don't, and in fact, often need to work on giving myself a little more self-importance, you know, because I still think of myself as the guy from Tucson. And what that allows me to do is look around at my friends, and I just cannot name them here, but I know the ones that I, and their friends and acquaintances, that often turn my stomach because they think they're great, and they think that they're important, and they have this aura of self-importance that has nothing to do with being a human being, and they become affected, and I'm able to see that clearly, and that's why I wanted to do this show is to you know, expose that and show how fake it is in terms of our real, you know, real life existence. I wish I could name names, but I just have friends who do movies and big movies, and my God, they have attitudes.
Yeah, one can only conclude
that. It irritates me. If I sound irritated about it, I it's something that really pushes one of my buttons. It's something that I really dislike.
Okay, so on the one hand, you could kind of, there's the risk of getting too big and really getting carried away by that. On the other hand, you also live in fear of, like, being washed up and doing infomercials for hair replacement or something.
Well, what's wrong with that? I'm doing one next week. What's the problem with that? Hi, this is Gary Shandling. Have you seen this new product? You spray it on your forehead, it makes it look like your hair comes down to your eyebrows. I'm telling you, I never looked younger. The Popeil Pocket Hair Sprayer. I think I just saw that. There's a product where you just spray the back of your head with basically, you know, a work crew comes in and spray paints the back of your head with black paint. And they say it's going to look like hair. Anyway.
So do you worry about this?
No, I mean, I worry about, you know, that I'm not growing or that I've reached my potential sometimes and sort of have to push myself to see if there's more there, you know, but I'm also, I also look sometimes for, I wish I could sort of get out of show business. I just don't know what I would do on a weekly basis. I fantasize about moving to Hawaii, you know.
Well, good luck with the series. I really enjoy it. And I'll let you get back to your car trouble.
Yeah, I'm going to try and get this car started and then, you know, probably sell it.
Thanks.
So if anybody's out there listening and wants a 92 Range Rover at a really good price, let
right.
me know.
Thanks a lot for your time. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Gary Shandling is the star of The Larry Sanders Show. It will run on 10 consecutive weeknights beginning Monday on HBO. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, not another coming-of-age film. Yes, but this one is so personal and intelligent, it really stands out. We'll talk about the new movie, Flirting, with Australian writer and director John Digen. And Stephen Schiff reviews Eddie Murphy's new movie, The Distinguished Gentleman, about a con man who cons his way into a congressional seat. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In New York City, the UN Security Council has voted approval of a U.S.-led military force to help get aid to thousands of starving people in Somalia. This move comes more than 1 year after severe food shortages and civil unrest were first reported in Somalia. But so far, international aid, to a large degree, has not reached those who need it most because of factional fighting and stealing in the nation. The UN resolution does not say how long the military operation will last. The first American combat troops could arrive in Somalia this weekend. NPR's Suni Khalid reports that the Bush administration expects little resistance from Somalia's warring factions.
Pentagon planners say an 1,800 Marine task force now on ships off the coast of Somalia's capital of Mogadishu will be the first U.S. forces to go ashore in a United Nations intervention. The Marines will be responsible for securing ports and airfields. They will also pave the way for an airlift of 16,000 troops from the 1st Marine Expeditionary Force based in Camp Pendleton, California. They will also be joined by 10,000 soldiers from the Army's 10th Mountain Division Light Infantry from Fort Drum, New York. The U.S. force will then try to secure roads, warehouses, and feeding centers for Somali famine victims. France, Italy, Belgium, and Canada have also pledged troops for the first step of the operation, which is aimed at protecting relief supplies to millions of Somalis now facing starvation. I'm Suni Khalid in Washington.
In Egypt, a military court has sentenced 8 suspected Muslim militants to death and given others life in prison. Laurie Neff reports from Cairo that these verdicts came at the conclusion of 2 separate trials held in the port city of Alexandria, where most of the suspects were captured.
The 8 suspected Islamic militants sentenced to death were convicted of planning to overthrow the government and assassinate some of its leaders. 7 of the 8 are still at large and were tried in absentia. In the other case, defendants were accused of forming and belonging to a secret group that aimed to undermine the government through terrorist means. At least 3 defendants in the 2 trials received life sentences. More than 20 others were handed lesser terms, and 9 defendants were acquitted. The trials were the first test of a new anti-terrorist law enacted in Egypt in response to a marked rise in extremist violence. The new law allows imposition of the death penalty or life imprisonment for those convicted of planning but not necessarily carrying out terrorist acts. For National Public Radio, I'm Laurie Neff in Cairo.
The Commerce Department says that factory orders were up for a second month in October, pushed up by demands for new cars and airplanes. The government says a 1.7% rise in October comes after a revised 1.3% increase in September. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down nearly 10 points to close at 3,276.53 in very heavy trading. This is NPR News. General Motors has announced plant closings that will affect some 18,000 auto workers. GM says that 9 plants in the United States and Canada will be closed, including assembly plants in Wilmington, Delaware, and Flint, Michigan, where close to 8,000 people now work. This latest announcement brings the number of plants GM has marked for closure to 23. two more than a target figure of 21 announced last year. At that time, the company said by 1995, 74 GM-1000 jobs would be done away with. 60 people who say that former Catholic priest James Porter abused them when they were children announced today that they have reached a settlement with the Massachusetts diocese where Porter worked in the 1960s. David Wright of member station WBUR reports.
The 68 alleged victims today would not say how much financial compensation they'll receive from the Diocese of Fall River, Massachusetts, where James Porter first became a priest. The group's attorney, Roderick McLeish, instead stressed the impact the case is having on the church's willingness to rethink its policies on sexual abuse and the clergy.
This is going to be a better church as a result of this case. It's going to be a church that's going to be more sensitive to the needs of children. And all of us who've been involved in the case have attempted to handle this in the most positive, constructive way possible.
The alleged victims have formed a foundation to provide assistance to sexual abuse victims. Former priest James Porter, meanwhile, is standing trial in Minnesota on charges of molesting a family babysitter. He also faces 46 criminal counts of sexual abuse here in Massachusetts. For National Public Radio, this is David Wright in Boston.
The government says that new claims for unemployment benefits dropped by some 12,000 in the latest reporting week. The Labor Department said today in Washington that claims were down to 362,000 in the week ending November 21st. Claims for the week were their lowest since the week of October 31st. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I guess I'm kind of tired of coming-of-age stories, so I was skeptical when I went to see the new film Flirting. Now I've been recommending it to my friends. My guest is the film's writer and director, John Digan. Flirting is the second part of a trilogy. The Year My Voice Broke was the first. The main character of the films is Danny Embling, played by the young Australian actor Noah Taylor. Flirting is set in an Australian boarding school. Danny is the alienated one. In this scene, the girls' school from across the lake has come to watch a football match. While everyone cheers on their team, Danny is lost in a book. Three girls come to flirt with Danny and his friend.
Good match.
Yeah. Three badly injured so far.
You don't sound very patriotic.
No, I'm not.
Aren't you interested in football?
Only from an anthropological viewpoint.
What are you talking about?
It's a form of mating ritual.
What?
That's why you're here, isn't it?
You'd arranged. Incredibly rude. Did you know that?
Yeah, well, that's why I haven't got any friends.
I'm not surprised.
I take pity on him.
Well, I'd say it's wasted. Come on.
The third girl in the scene, who you didn't hear, is on Danny's wavelength. They soon become girlfriend and boyfriend. She's from Uganda and is stuck at the boarding school because her father is a visiting professor at a nearby university in Australia. I asked Digan to describe the arc of his trilogy.
The arc is keyed on the character of Danny Embling, who is the one who goes through the three films. And it's really starting off with somebody who is quite unformed from a remote country town, whose eyes and senses are wide open to the world, but whose knowledge of the world is tiny. And it's seeing him going through a series of journeys, soaking up influences like a sponge, and in some ways blossoming through that, but also perhaps in some ways losing certain qualities which perhaps later in life he might be able to identify.
I want to ask you what inspired the main characters in your new movie. Yeah, let's start with Danny, with the young man. He's a very kind of reflective person, kind of a nonconformist, stuttering, always carrying around books by Sartre or thinking about Camus. What inspired him?
I wanted to have a character who was something of an outsider and someone who was unformed at the beginning of the trilogy and who would go through the three films that form it and gradually evolve. His cultural awareness of the world is really quite limited, but on the other hand, he's very bright, a very perceptive guy, essentially an observer.
The other main character is a young woman named Tandawe, whose parents are she's from Uganda. Her father is a university professor and an African nationalist. She's smart, she's sophisticated, she's confident, and she's attractive. She's really a wonderful character. Was she based on somebody who you once knew?
No, she wasn't, certainly as far as I'm aware. She's someone that I wanted to have a character who came from a completely different world to anything that Danny had experienced before. And so I chose Africa as the place where she comes from, because that's about as far away from Australia and Australian life as I thought you could find. Also, I was interested in the political opportunities that having a character from that part of the world gave me, and particularly coming from a former colony, the contrast and experience that she has had to the experiences that Danny has as a product of another very different kind of British colony.
Well, what she has to deal with in her country is, you know, dictators and imprisonment, assassinations. It opens up a whole new world to Danny to be exposed to this. Did anything like that ever happen to you, that you met somebody whose world was so different and in a way so much bigger and more dangerous?
For me, my experience, I suppose, that's closest to this one that he has, was that when I was 10, I went out to Malaya, as it then was, and Malaya had just come through the period of the emergency, where they had been fighting against the communists. So I had a sort of awareness of that kind of cathartic situation that had torn apart that country. But as far as I'm aware, again, I never met someone who has quite the set of effects that Tandawe triggers off in Danny, because, as you say, it really is, the relationship really opens up a whole series of new perspectives to him.
How did you find Noah Taylor, who plays the main character in the trilogy?
I was very fortunate that I saw his photograph and I was able to just audition him in quite orthodox circumstances. The picture was shown to me by the casting agent that I was working with.
It was one of these kind of faceless press photos where it's like generic actor photo, or did he have more character in that?
I don't think he could ever really be a generic actor photo. He's such an idiosyncratic looking young man that his face really jumps out from any photograph you look at. It was, I think, something that had been taken probably as a still for him as an actor, but it still was enough of his personality shone through it to make me immediately interested in him.
When you work with an actor for a couple of films and he's playing the same character, is it interesting to see how he's changed? I mean, did Noah Taylor change a lot between the first film that you made with him, The Year My Voice Broke, and the current film, Flirting?
He did in some ways. He's very different as an individual to the character he plays. He's really, in real life, he lives on the edge much more than the character of Danny. He's not so much an observer. He's more a doer. But he I think, has a great compassion and understanding for this character that he plays. He really enjoys playing Danny, and I think he, in a way, the very fact that he is so different allows him to be very committed in the way he plays the part. He has that great gift that the best film actors have of simplicity, but expressing a great depth in very economical ways.
Is the character of Danny a surrogate for you? Do you identify with him?
Oh, yes, I do. He's not a duplication of me. I mean, his experiences in some ways are similar, but my background is very different. I was born in England. I lived in Malaya. I did go to a boarding school that was very like St. Albans, and I used those experiences to as a background to the film. I really described the environment that I went to school in. We did have a sister school, as in Flirting. It wasn't across a lake, but we did do plays together. It was a way of actually meeting girls to participate in the plays. I used the character probably to describe something of my evolving sensibilities, I suppose. Sometimes consciously, sometimes unconsciously. I suppose I am working things out through the character myself, but it's not autobiographical in that I can embroider things that happened to me, and I don't feel that I'm slavishly making my own story.
Well, I'm interested in your story. You were born in England, lived there for the first 10 years of your life. Why did your family move to Australia afterwards?
Well, my father was Australian. He had actually joined the Royal Air Force for World War II, as quite a lot of Australians did. And he married my mother, who was also in the Air Force during the war. And at the end of his Air Force career, he retired and returned to Australia with the family.
So did you live in a small town in Australia, like your main character?
I went straight into boarding school, actually, but we were living in a smallish town, and a lot of my relatives live in places rather like the town of Borregaard, where Danny's character comes from. And I did spend time working on farms during my holidays, doing things like working in wool sheds and clearing land, this sort of thing.
If the boarding school you went to as soon as you got to Australia is anything like the provincial and repressive boarding school in your movie, it must have been a really disorienting experience to be in a new country and to, at the same time, be shut off from that country in this repressive boarding school.
The biggest single difference was the whole cultural thing of being a young English boy, because I had a very strong English accent, someone who'd played often very different sports to the ones that were played there. And I went through a similar kind of persecution that Danny goes through, I guess, until I managed to lose my English accent. But one of the differences between he and I is that I actually like sport very much, and I was very active in the sporting area. Whereas Danny is gently contemptuous of that part of the school life.
Your movie Flirting opens with a scene where several of the male students are getting caned. And it's the headmaster seems like a pretty sadistic kind of guy. Did you get caned a lot in school?
When I first went there, we would get caned methodically just about every week. When we were older, it was less frequent, but I still got two lots of six of the best on consecutive days shortly before I sat my final exams, which made it quite painful to sit down, actually. So the caning thing was, it was a very major part of the whole punishment system there, probably the major one.
How afraid of caning were you?
It actually got worse when you were about 11, which is what I was when I first went, because it was so common and it would happen to practically everybody. You wouldn't really mind much. You'd take it in your stride. Maybe they used to hit harder the older that you get, but we did have a teacher who would put chalk on his cane, as the one in the film does, in order to try and hit the same spot. And so that kind of interest in exacting the worst possible agony was very accurate. If he managed to hit the same spot three times, it would on occasions actually break the skin. It was very painful.
Did you complain to your parents about it, or did you just accept that's the way it is at boarding school?
You accept that that's the way it is, really. We never thought much of it.
My guest is John Digan, writer and director of the new film Flirting. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Australian writer and director John Digan. Now, I know you were involved in an experimental theater troupe when you were younger, and I'm wondering if you feel that you've kept that kind of sense of adventurousness of trying new things in your movies.
What I try to keep in the movies and that I do and what I value most is the work with the actors, and I'm trying to always break through the elements of the mechanics of filmmaking that prevent acting from being as fresh and as real as it can be.
Did you try acting on film yourself so that you understood it better from the actor's perspective before directing?
No, it wasn't as conscious as that. I was, in fact, expecting to be an actor and a writer rather than a director. The thought of directing was not something that, like many of the great directors, was not something that I had from the beginning.
So why did you start?
I was rather a self-indulgent actor, I think, and I felt that I needed quite a lot of help, and a lot of the directors that I worked with when I was starting off had come from very technical backgrounds, and they didn't actually give a lot of direction to the actors. They spent more time with the camera. This was... These films are not particularly memorable films. They're mainly experimental films. But that sense of feeling that I needed help that I wasn't getting prompted me to feel that I could maybe redress that balance if I was working with actors as a director myself.
One last question. Are you hoping to get a multi-gazillion-dollar offer from a big American company to come over here and make movies, or would you rather keep it small and keep it personal?
I think I will always make films that are considered small, if you like, that are focused primarily on character, because it's character-based films that interest me more, say, than films that star car chases. But, I mean, if I was offered a script which I really liked and that had a huge budget, it would be terrific. I certainly wouldn't knock it back now. I'd be delighted to have the opportunity of working on something that had a lengthy shooting schedule.
Well, we'll keep that in mind.
Okay.
Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks very much, Terry.
John Digan wrote and directed the film Flirting. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what do you have from Bosnia?
We have a report from Tom Jelton today on the children of Bosnia and what kind of psychological impact the war has had on them and is likely to have. Tom has spoken with children and with psychiatrists working with them in the former Yugoslavia. Also today, we'll talk with a German law professor about the German constitutional provisions called militant democracy that empower the government to ban organizations, or as it did yesterday, even ban recorded music that incites people to racial violence. And also a contest. Now that we're going to have hundreds and hundreds, possibly, of cable television channels, what do you think we should show on them?
Okay, that and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Five years ago, Eddie Murphy was one of the two or three biggest stars in the world. But his last three films, Harlem Nights, Another 48 Hours, and Boomerang, have been box office disappointments. The people at Walt Disney are billing his new picture as a return to form, a naughty satirical comedy in the spirit of one of his biggest hits, Trading Places. Film critic Stephen Schiff went to see The Distinguished Gentleman.
Here's what I can't figure out. The Distinguished Gentleman is a political comedy. It's about what happens when a Florida congressman named Jeff Johnson dies, and a wily con man, also named Jeff Johnson, is elected on name recognition alone. The man who wrote and executive produced the film is Marty Kaplan, and I can't think of anyone better qualified to write a political comedy. Kaplan was Walter Mondale's chief speechwriter and deputy campaign manager. His wife, Susan Estrich, ran Michael Dukakis' campaign. Kaplan has a doctorate in modern thought from Stanford, and he was once the president of the Harvard Lampoon. Now, after a stint as a Disney VP, he's writing and producing movies on his own. From all this, we can conclude one of two things. Either Kaplan lost every battle he fought in those notorious Disney script conferences, or else California scientists should look into the combined effects of smog and tofu on higher brain function. It's true that the distinguished gentleman is topical. There are references in it to the SNL scandal, to PACs and lobbyists and campaign abuses. But Kaplan and director Jonathan Lynn have waded into waters that are so familiar they've become stagnant. Comedies about con men and boobs getting elected to high office have been standard fare since the days of The Great Man Votes and Of Thee I Sing. And just this year we've already had Bob Roberts, a so-so movie that nevertheless leaves the distinguished gentleman gargling pond scum. As Jeff Johnson, Eddie Murphy has some fun campaigning for himself, riding through different ethnic neighborhoods in a sound truck and showing off the various Jewish, Chinese, and street black accents he does so well. But once the election is won, about a half hour into the movie, we get the sort of toothless political satire that wouldn't pass muster in a summer camp skit. This victory speech, for instance.
People, we ran a positive campaign. We campaigned on the issue. The issue is change. Change for the future. The people have spoken. Ask not what your country can do for you. You have nothing to fear but fear itself. If you can't stand the heat, get out of the kitchen. Live free or die. And in conclusion, read my lips.
Eddie Murphy's probably better than most people at delivering lame material like that, but he's not as good as he used to be. Wearing a haircut that makes him look more Gumby-esque than ever, Murphy spends the movie popping his eyes and indulging his Donkey Bray laugh. But his performance looks tight and artificial, and his timing's way off. Strangest of all, Murphy seems to have lost his cool. The sense of loosey-goosey street savvy and knowingness that gave his performances in Trading Places and Beverly Hills Cop such a kick has evaporated. Those movies were about what it was to be a down-to-earth person in a highfalutin world, but Murphy can't transfer that conceit to Washington. Even Ted Kennedy looks more down-to-earth than he does. It isn't long before the movie devolves into a standard Disney formula. Jeff Johnson reforms for the love of a good woman. And that's pretty cornball stuff. But by the time it arrives, whatever life and insight the movie might have offered has long since been eaten away. Memo to Marty Kaplan. Yes, Washington corrupts, but Hollywood corrupts absolutely.
Stephen Schiff is critic-at-large for The New Yorker. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Joan Tuohy, and Roberta Shurrock, with Sue Weinstein. Research assistance from Penny Nelson. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Guys and Dolls. We talk about the making of the new Broadway cast album with the show's musical director, Edward Strauss. And we hear the show's composer sing. There's a new CD featuring Frank Lesser's demo recordings. We'll talk with the record's producer. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.